1:34:05 p.m. on the 8th day of February, 2011. We have just one measure before us today. That's House Bill 21, modifications to the Suicide Prevention Council membership. And we're, my loss here next to me is the camera's gain. esteemed colleague, Representative Fairclough from the breakaway public of Eagle River.
The other members.
And everybody's here except for, we have here Representative T. Wilson, Stoltz, co-chair, Thomas Dugan, Edgman, Costello, Newman, Fairclough. Others may join us. We have a quorum to proceed. With that correction by my able co-chair.
And donors from Marvin Yoder today. Thank you, Marvin.
That, Representative Fairclough, when we have a CS, so why don't you describe the CS and then we'll go
Thank
through
Mr.
the procedures
Chairman.
To adopt that after you presented it.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gardner and myself serve on Alaska Suicide Prevention Council, and with the support of the council, they've asked us to move forward on two changes to the current state statute regarding suicide prevention in our state. What you'll find on the CS is the only change that there is on page two, line 15. On the previous version, it said, when appointed, is at least 16 but not more than 20 years of age. Representative Gardner and I read the meeting minute notes incorrectly, and we attended a follow-up meeting to approve those meeting minutes and found out that it should be 24. And I can speak to that change if you'd like.
Go ahead, just for the record. So it's not a very complicated bill. Let's talk about what's in there.
Mr. Chairman, the change that's on the CS moves it from 20 to 24, creating an age. Previously, what's before you is a request to change the age from 9th, 10th, 11th, and 12th grade to actually a number of years. And there's a couple reasons for that. But specifically from the 20 to 24, it's so that college students could continue to participate on the council. The original move from the 16 to 20 and now the 16 to 24 is to allow a youth who might want to participate to start in high school. And what we found at the council level is that beginning time usually started in 11th and 12th grade versus 9th and 10th. And so just with the sensitivity of the subject and being able to talk about death and a tragic death, we thought, the council thought that it would be more appropriate to change that to a 16 to 24 to allow a continuum of information to go through college years.
For the record, we've been joined by Representative Jewell, Representative Guerra, and Representative Keller joining the committee.
Chairman, the only thing else that's a modification of statute is taking the numbers from 16 members to 17. That particular request is being asked for because of the increased number of suicides that are happening in our military population and a desire to make sure that there's a military presence that's influencing the board as we move forward in prevention strategies for the state of Alaska.
Representative T. Wilson.
Thank you, Chair. I just have one question. I'm just curious why you could not have put this position in with somebody that already originates.
Mr. Chairman, if you open your book, through the chair, Representative Wilson, not used to sitting over on this side. If you look at page 5 on Mending the Net, Suicide Prevention in Alaska at the Annual Report, 2010, page 5 lists out the different people that participate. Certainly it's up to this body if you'd like to substitute in someone else. The position of the board and Representative Gardner and myself is the military personnel is an addition, not in a replacement. We believe that their conversation would be valuable in addition to the Department of Health and Social Service being at the table, the Department of Education, Alcoholism and Drug Abuse, the Mental Health Board, Alaska Federation of Natives, one person who works in a high school, one youth person, one person who's experienced a death by suicide of a family member, one rural resident off of the road system, a member of the clergy, and a youth that's in secondary school, and one public member. So certainly it's in deference to this body, you could replace somebody, but in addition, from 16 to 17, that provides an odd number if there is a tie. Typically, we work as a consensus group versus a voting group, but in the event of a tie, 17 would give us that number.
Thank you.
Another question. Representative Fairclough, just want to make sure on the intent. The person added on subsection J, and that on the ages from, just want to make sure when we have those prescriptive ages, that's just want to make sure that is the board restricted to only one person that falls within that, if there's another 22-year-old? And then similarly with the veterans position, it says one person. With the demographics of our veterans population, I just want to make sure it's been crafted that it doesn't prohibit the board to only one veteran, because of I wouldn't want to have a restriction of only one person. It was the intent, at least one person.
Mr. Chairman, the intent is at least one person. Each of the categories are a representation in a cross-section of the state, but many members serving on the board carry with them different hats under each of these categories that we think is important to moving forward, education and engagement of the population in suicide prevention.
Well, I just wanted the commentary in this committee to reflect that. I think it's probably, I wouldn't want the administration to point to this and think, okay, we'll have our one veteran when out of 17, and I think there you could have half a dozen veterans on there that fill other. I wouldn't want to prohibit them. I know that's not your intent. Representative Guerra.
Thank you. Representative Fairclough, if you answer this while I was gone, it's my punishment, and you don't have to answer the question again. But to deal with the problem, sometimes the council has faced with not everybody attending. Is there a way to lower the quorum that would still allow the commission to act? Would there be any interest in doing that?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, that was done in a previous bill, the last legislative session, and so this number change does not affect the quorum, and it is reduced, and the council has not had an issue with quorum since we passed last year's bill. Actually, when Representative Gardner and I joined the council, we haven't, to my knowledge, experienced a quorum since. We are non-voting members as representatives of this body, but our last fix took care of that particular issue.
You. And then just one other question.
And since you did ask for punishment, I will all assess a dozen donuts next meeting. So. Go ahead, Representative Vera.
I wonder if it makes me feel good about that, as I know I buy the good ones.
Those are good.
This question really has nothing to do with the bill. It just has to do with, it would just help educate me. And I don't know that there's a good answer to it. But if you are serious about your desire to commit suicide, and you tell somebody in authority that you're serious about it, they, at some level of seriousness, they have an obligation to report you, which makes sense on one hand. But do you think that also deters people from seeking help? And is there, even if it does, I don't know that there's any answer to it, but that's always been something that's stuck in the back of my head, that many people don't seek help when they're on the verge because they know that institutionalizes them.
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, I think that, I know that the council had a conversation the last time we met on that particular issue, and there are two different philosophies. The first philosophy is when someone is so close to suicide that anything rational really isn't entering the brain, and they you can't defer them from that particular choice at that particular moment in time. What some of us at the council prefer as an alternate to that particular thought process is that if you actually engage with the people of Alaska, with the youth of Alaska who are completing suicides, and talk to them about their future and about choices and about hope that's out there, that they will think about it and they will reach out for help instead of thinking that suicide is the only alternative to their particular circumstance. It's very complicated, Representative Gary, and I appreciate the complexity of the question. Mr. Chairman, if I might, I did have an opening remark that was just 2 or 3 minutes, if I might.
One remark is to Richard Rins?
It is, sir.
Go ahead.
It does explain this, yes, Representative Stoltz.
And what, Representative Thomas, can you move the CS so it's before us? And I'll object.
You're ready to move it now?
No. Just move the adopt the
adoption,
CS.
Yeah.
I should have done this a little earlier.
Who's your
first act jitters?
And CS, House Bill Number 21, Version 27, LS0154/D as a moving document.
And I'll object to continue our discussion.
Working document.
Mr. Co-Chairs, members of the committee, Alaska experiences suicide twice the national rate. In Alaska, 15 to 24-year-olds have the highest rate of suicides, with Alaska Natives being the highest rate of ethnicity in the entire United States for suicide, specifically male Alaskans 15 to 24. Suicide is one of the top 10 causes of death in Alaska. That's noted on page 11 of the annual report. On page 20, we talk about the public health model to start addressing this crisis in the state of Alaska. We talk about community readiness and a willingness for local communities to take on the issues internal to them, taking personal responsibility for what's happening in their community and trying to outline a path as a way forward. If I could get you to refer to your Mending the Nets, I'll just highlight a few points that the council's put together. And would like to say thank you to Kate Burkhart, our new executive director, James, who's been working with us, as well as Eric, to try to move the council forward. For a period of 2 years, the council had been without assistance from the administration and just through in the hiring process and being able to get someone to help the council. And that's why we're on the right path right now. Mr. Chairman, members of House Finance, on page 6, in 2009, 140 Alaskans completed suicide. The average age is 20 years old. If I can refer you to page 7, the top line. Between 2000 and 2009, there were 1,369 confirmed suicides in Alaska. Those suicides occurred in 176 communities, where school districts and local community councils and villages discussed what happened and the tragedy that those families faced in the loss of a loved one. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, on page 8, under suicide and ethnicity, the last paragraph before the charts, Alaska Native individuals are twice as likely to commit suicide as individuals of other ethnicities. If you turn to page 9, you'll see a chart where what I spoke to originally was the 15 to 24-year-old age group. And again, in Alaska, young people 15 to 24 continue to have the highest rates of suicide. But if you look at the curve, while suicide goes down as one starts to age, at 65 to 64, an alternate happens and we start moving up in suicides. Many reasons could contribute to this. Cancer statistics, loss of hope as one grows older. We're not sure. But if you move on to page 10 under suicide and substance abuse, the end of the first paragraph, 44% tested positive for alcohol and 48% had one or more drug present in their body when they passed away. Mr. Chairman, that's all I'm going to highlight on the document that you have in front of you. I just wanted to bring home, hopefully, the impact to families that are experiencing the loss of a loved one and tell you that the Suicide Prevention Council of Alaska is working hard as quickly as they can to provide a strategic plan to bring before the legislature in hopes to prevent suicide in the state of Alaska.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Fairclough, you'd mentioned drugs and alcohol being part of the problem. Where does unemployment fit in there? There's more problems than besides just drugs and alcohol is why people commit suicide. And do you have a list of, you know, the work that you've done that identify why people commit suicide?
Chairman, on page 12, through the chair, Representative Newman, page 12 specifically addresses, does unemployment affect suicide rates? While we don't have necessarily a direct tie, what we do know is when there's a lack of hope inside of a community and an inability to provide for a family or for oneself, that there are high rates of suicide.
Well, Representative Fairclough, again, so you've got a lot of different reasons probably why. Is there your own sense why of, and you've done a lot of work in this area, of the different reasons of why people may commit suicide? I know there's drug or alcohol may be involved, but you don't have a job. Is there a range of things? That's kind of where I was trying to get to. And it may not be in a statistic, but you've been doing this long enough where I just maybe ask you that question.
Through the chair, Representative Newman, certainly specific to the age group of 15 through 24, hormones are going and life experiences are less than other adults. And during that time when you have a relationship or are starting to develop relationships, girlfriend, boyfriend is what I'm referring to, if there's a loss of a girlfriend or a boyfriend or even someone else that's significantly close to you, youth that aren't resilient, who don't have the skills to cope with those events in their lives, may consider that this is the end, that there's nothing better. And certainly a community that has adults that can be around other youth, people that can be around people to make sure that other people feel like they have value, that they can contribute, is a significant factor. Rural Alaska experiences a higher number of per ratio suicides, but Anchorage actually had the highest amount of deaths. So it's not a rural and urban issue, though it's more prevalent in rural communities. It's a social issue. Alcohol and drugs may be on board because the person is contemplating something they really don't want to feel. It might not mean that they have a substance or drug abuse. It just means that it might be present at that particular time. Child abuse, violence in the home, anything is a possibility for someone feeling hopeless. But in the end, the conversation that we've had at the council level, it's really about hope and about factors that are around a particular youth or a person in their ability to feel connected to a community that cares about them.
Well, a little self-confidence there. Is there indicators that would indicate, what indicators are there, maybe self-mutilation or things like that, that would be indicators of somebody who has thoughts of maybe suicide?
If I could ask Kate Burkhardt to join me.
Just trying to learn. And it doesn't have to do with the bill so much, Mr. Chair, but trying to learn.
Kate Burkhardt, I'm the director of the Statewide Suicide Prevention Council, Representative Newman through the chair. There are many warning signs that we work hard to educate people about. Sometimes it involves self-harm. Sometimes it's an extreme change in mood, which often people think means for the worse. But sometimes it can be an extreme change for the better. We just received public comment from a father in Bethel who was very surprised that his son, right before committing suicide, was actually way happier than they had seen him in a long time. So it's those extreme mood changes. A disinterest in activities in which the person had been very interested in, like sports or church or activities like that. Increased attention to what we call lethal means, like making sure they know where a firearm is or what's in the medicine cabinet. And then major signs are actual disclosures, things like they may not be as overt as what Representative Guerra talked about, like I plan to commit suicide, but disclosures like I just don't want to be here anymore or life doesn't have meaning or those kinds of things. And so the education and prevention and intervention models like Gatekeeper and Applied Skills, Applied Suicide Intervention Skills Training, those focus on educating folks to pick up on those less extreme warning signs so that people can be connected to services long before they have a plan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? I'll remove my objection to adoption of CS. Are there any other objections maintained? The CS is before us. I think we've already vetted most of the questions on it. Unless there's a, we'll go to the fiscal note. We added a ute.
Mr. Co-Chair, there's a $4,000 fiscal note which would cover dependent on where a person travels from. It's an estimate. When we try to have one rural meeting per year to make sure we hear what a community has to say about this issue from a regional perspective. It doesn't always have to be rural, but there are sometimes travel costs associated with this particular council.
Just given we have the $123 million man behind us, that's $4,000 on the single one. To set the frame for our next discussion after this, any other questions? We're going to take a very brief at ease, so the sponsor can join us back at the table and move her bill. So, brief at ease. In place. I'll repeat myself. Is there anybody out on the network that wished to testify in this bill?
Nope.
Anybody in the building? Going gone. Public testimony is closed. Representative Fairclough.
Mr. Chairman, I move from committee the CS for House Bill 21 Finance 27-LSO154/D from committee with attached fiscal notes and individual committee recommendations.
Is there any objection? No objections noted. That bill is moved from committee. We'll take a very brief at ease again.
hands back to over here. Our commissioner, Bill Spur from Hess, and we're going to be doing Medicaid 101 after that discussion. So you have slides. That, you know, usually we go through one slide if there's questions, just to keep some sort of order here. And you're lucky you have an hour and a half to get this to us.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me here today. For the record, I am Bill Stewart, Commissioner, Department of Health and Social Services, and we're going to give you an overview of the $123 million challenge that we have that has received such fame here today. Thank you for that, Mr. Chairman. With me is Kim Poppy Smart. And Kim is the Director of Healthcare Services, overseeing the Medicaid budget itself, and the person who I'm handing all the responsibility for the $123 million challenge that we have. You'll be seeing lots of Kim over the next couple of weeks as she presents the Medicaid budget and the various parts. For those of you over on my right-hand side, thank you. Evidently, somebody moved the projector, and nobody is tall enough here to adjust it, so... they've called out for support on it, and I believe you all should have a handout as well to be able to follow, and I apologize for that. It just was brought to my attention a moment ago. Before I begin, you should have a copy of the presentation in front of you. There's also one sheet that, figure 29, that has been added to the presentation. Figure 29 becomes, the old figure 29 becomes figure 30. And then figure 30 becomes 31, and 31 goes away. So I apologize for that. It's a last-minute correction that we made. The intent of what I'm going to do here today is kind of present, first of all, a Misery Loves Company and show you the national perspective on what we have and where Alaska fits with the national perspective, but also we'll be then moving into the significance of our issue, what we're facing, what actions we're taking with the Medicaid Task Force and others as we pursue it. And even though the Medicaid Task Force has stumbled a bit, we continue to move ahead with our efforts on Medicaid reform for Alaska because we do need to do something about it. We need to fix the issue. We need to address the issue, and we need to bend the curve, as you will hear time and again throughout the next few weeks. Looking at where Medicaid is gone. I've been in healthcare for 37 years, and one of the things that we constantly talk about is the up and down trends in Medicaid. They go in four-year cycles, 4 years of up, 4 years of down. Nobody can really explain why it happens. We think it has a lot to do with the economy and the economy, economic upturns and downturns that seem to occur in similar cycles, but Medicaid is almost like clockwork in terms of the up and down cycles. And this, I think, shows you the significance of, a little bit of the significance of what I'm talking about. 2010, 6.6% we receive further on in my next slide, that the state of Alaska actually experienced a 14.2% increase in our budget between 2008 and 2010. That is from minus 2.8% to 14.2% positive in that 2 year time frame. And to say the least, that's very concerning because associated with that has been an increase in our enrollment, increase in the cost for services, and overall budget. Total Medicaid spending in the U.S. Between 2000 and 2010, see that Alaska has been mostly at or close to the other states for the period through 2008. And then in 2009 and 10, we benefited from the largesse of the federal government with the FMAP enhancement. FMAP enhancement is the federal Medicaid assistance percentage, and we went from roughly 51.9% to around 62% federal contribution. So it was, we were able to reduce our general fund contribution during those 2 years In 2009, we reduced our contribution by approximately $74 million. 2010, it was $102 million, and I believe for 2011, we are going to save about $114 million in general fund contribution for the year. Looking at spending growth itself, you can see the overall trend just for the state of Alaska and the ups and downs that we've had with both federal contribution increases and decreases, and as well as the state general fund. 2010, even though we benefited to the tune of $102 million from the largesse of the federal government, we still had increased spending of general fund dollars for the year because of the growth that we experienced primarily in enrollment. 2012, fiscal year 2012, beginning July 2011, the largesse comes to an end. And the ARRA funding, the stimulus funding, goes away. On the average, states will see an increase in the non-federal share by over 30% due to the loss of FMAP inflation and with enrollment growth. California, the biggest state with a 50% FMAP, will see, not could see, we now know that they will see a 30% growth in their non-federal share. In fact, they're projecting close to 37%. Arkansas with 71.37% will see 44% due to the great downturn of the economy in Arkansas. Florida, 55, will see 36%. Alaska will see a 38% increase in the non-federal share due to the loss of FMAP, inflation, and enrollment growth. And that is the genesis of the $123 million amount that we're talking about. Options. When I met with the Medicaid Task Force, we laid out options. And when we look at the list of options, it is sort of like choosing your poison. Which option are you going to gore? What are we going to address? Are we going to pick on providers? Are we going to pick on recipients? Where is it? So we looked at eligibility. Eligibility, because of maintenance of effort, one of the basic tenets of the stimulus money, maintenance of effort, says that you can't change the services that you're providing to the people that you're providing them to. Eligibility has to be taken off the table through 2014, until 2014, through 2013. Provider rates. I think provider rates is always something that's looked at. Many of the states, as we'll see shortly, are looking at provider rates as one of the solutions. Benefits. And can we take a look at the benefit package that we're providing? Increased utilization controls. One of the issues with increased utilization controls is maintenance of effort, yet again. But it is one of the, as you'll see, is one of the areas that we're looking at. Improved purchasing. Improved purchasing works in other states. For instance, you durable medical equipment, you may choose a single vendor for the entire state. In Alaska, it just doesn't work because we don't have any very large durable medical equipment vendors to be able to pick up the statewide issue. And it is a challenge for us because of the geographic separation that we have and the ability to provide timely the durable medical equipment that's required. Cost sharing, everybody always wants to look at cost sharing. Anti-fraud. I don't know what the solution is on anti-fraud. There are people that would say that we have a lot of money in anti-fraud in the state, and there are those that say that there isn't there. We are going to continue our anti-fraud efforts regardless. And I actually stepped them up. I've met with the Attorney General on this, and we're going to continue to pursue this. Recipient anti-fraud is going to get you a little bit. Provider anti-fraud is probably where the areas are. But nothing like the state of Florida, the state of New York, where you know, they've uncovered these mafia rings, as it's alleged, and I'm talking billions of dollars in primarily Medicare fraud at this point. But the states are going to be required to mimic what Medicare is doing in its efforts, and we'll talk more about that as we go.
Your very question, Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm afraid I'm one slide behind you. I had a couple of questions. about the increase in basically Alaska's share of the costs here. One is, when it says non-federal share, is that synonymous with state share, or is there something else that's being included in that phrase?
Through the chair, Representative Dugan, that is the state share.
That is strictly the state share.
There's a small percentage of other funding, but it's primarily the state share.
Thank you. And, Mr. Chairman, if I might, 38% increase due to the loss of FMAP, inflation, and enrollment growth. Can you tell me what's what in that? How much of that is loss of FMAP? How much is inflation, and how much is enrollment growth?
Through the chair, Representative Duga, I can give you that detail. I don't know if I have it in this slide deck, but I can get that for you very definitely.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Jewell from Indiana.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, I think at the beginning of this slide, you made a statement that we benefited from RO this year to the tune of about $104 or $114 million. Then you ended with this slide of a 38% increase, and I'm just wondering how those two figures work together.
Through the chair, Representative Jewell, beginning in 2012, it's the 38% increase that we're going to see in the non-federal share. 2011, we benefited.
July 1.
Yes, sir.
Benefit is up to July 1.
Benefited up to July 1, yes, sir.
Thank you.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Commissioner. You talked about the fraud prosecutions possibly against providers, and I would just make this request that the rules are complex. You could make a fraud case against somebody who makes an innocent mistake, and I know between you and the Attorney General, you're going to have to decide which cases to pursue and which ones not to, and I would just ask that you be sensitive to not trying to make fraud cases against folks who make mistakes. I mean, those are cases that could be pushed as fraud cases.
Representative Guerra, through the chair, very definitely. We are attempting to differentiate between what we call ministerial errors and just out-and-out fraud errors. And it's easy enough to make an error by transposing a number, by not having adequate documentation in the chart to support something which is more of a ministerial error than somebody upcoding a series of events and things. So very definitely, sir.
Thank you.
Eligibility. I've already talked about this a little bit. It's normally an option that states use to control budget. The state of Alaska has not provided much in additional services to a population beyond basic Medicaid levels, other than in perhaps the Denali Kid Care, and right now we're at the 175% level, which most of the states are at with Denali Kid Care. But in addition, this option is prevented by maintenance of effort through both ARA and which was a stimulus bill, and PPACA, the Affordable Care Act, until 2014. Beginning in 2014, Medicaid goes from 100% of poverty level to 138% of poverty level, and at that time, the restrictions on maintenance of effort come off, but the basic Medicaid level will be at 138%. Cannot adopt more restrictive standards, methodologies, or procedures regarding eligibility or enrollment in the Medicaid program.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you tell what age bracket is this growing? Are we growing because of the children, or is it senior population? Where's the growth happening?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, the growth is pretty much across the board. It's more related to families than it is any specific age group. You know, we could say that our seniors are growing. The seniors in terms of actual increased enrollment in Medicaid, it's not growth. It's in children and families that we're seeing it.
Follow-up, sir. And how much of those are new cases? I mean, like new families coming in. I know you can have a family and they have other children. They're already enrolled. Do we know if there's, is there a way to tell how many are new families still coming on because of hardship?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I don't have that number with me today, but we can provide that information to you, yes.
Thank you.
Provider rates, most common reduction by states. I could list the states that are doing it, but it's Kentucky, Arizona, California, Washington. Washington's just imposed a 15% rate cut to providers. Many rate reduction options, considerations reducing rates in one area may cause the cost increase in another. One of the things that with healthcare that I've learned over the years is that when you push, it's sort of like a balloon. You push in one area, it's going to bulge in another area. And so that has to be considered in whatever we do. Potential litigation, I'm less worried about that in Alaska, as we'll talk about it here shortly. CMS is involved in everything that we do, and there's nothing that we do that doesn't require a state plan amendment. And that's why you've heard the phrase about block grants, states wanting to get a block grant from the feds and put everything under this block grant, and it's just being able to provide Medicaid services the way that they do. And there's a good argument for it right there. But if we change the way that we provide reimbursement to providers, it very definitely shows that needs to show up in a state plan amendment in almost every case.
Representative Fairclough.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to, depending on the room that we're in, acronyms mean different things. So CMS, if we could hear what that is in this particular meeting.
Through the chair, Representative Faircloth, that's the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And for the future, I'll try to, because there's lots of them.
Representative Jewell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the provider rates, on these bullets, if we try and impact provider rights, generally means lowering them?
The chair represents you generally, yes.
So the consequence of lowering rates to providers, does that mean we run the potential of providers maybe saying, well, geez, if I can't do this here, I'll go do it someplace else and leave it?
Through the chair, Representative Jewell, we always face that. Yes, we do. And in subsequent slides, following slides, I'll talk a little bit about that. But I think Medicare is a good example of where we have experienced that in the state.
Thank you.
However, we sat in a pretty good position right now. Medicaid, physician fees.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Representative Kellogg is going to join us. He has a question.
Thank you, Commissioner. I was just wondering if you have an idea of what the process would be if we go into a rate reduction. Would it be a straight, flat percentage? Who would be in charge of saying this gets cut and this doesn't? There's a huge difference in the size of influence of different providers, and I can see that as a potential pending problem. I just wondered if you'd comment on it.
Representative Keller, through the chair, I kind of have a tongue-in-cheek response, as I'd love to be able to give that responsibility to the legislature, but I'm afraid that it will continue to fall with the department to do. And I think that it probably wouldn't be an across-the-board cut to all providers, but be a cut to certain provider groups and certain provider types. And that would have to be determined on doing studies just like the one that I presently have up on the screen that shows where our reimbursement fits with regards to other states, commercial carriers, Medicare, and other options. Because we are an outlier in many areas, and we are in the middle of the pack in other areas.
I just wanted to explain that I wasn't trying to grandstand or anything. I just want that question on the record because I see it as a pending issue and that we're going to have to face as a whole department and legislature. So thank you.
Representative Garrett.
Commissioner, let me ask you this. It's it shows that Alaska is one of the higher paying Medicaid states. And it's been explained to me, and I could misunderstand this, that in a related manner, when insurance companies are required to reimburse medical providers, in most states they're supposed to reimburse at what might be the average rate, but in Alaska they're required to reimburse at like at the 70th percentile, which may be an explanation for why medical rates are higher in Alaska. Does that sound at all familiar to you? Does that sound like misinformation?
Representative Garrett, through the chair, that comes into play, but it's less so in Medicaid than it is in the commercial world.
Just through the chair, but if it's happening in the commercial world where Alaska providers are allowed to bill at a higher rate to get insurance reimbursement, isn't that going to come into play in providers saying, this is what I get in the private world? If you lower my Medicaid rate, you're really paying us far less than what we get in the private world?
Through the chair, Representative Garrett, that is the case, and it is the case right now. We are experiencing that right now, less so with Medicaid than it is with Medicare. And if the next slide or the slide after I do a side-by-side comparison, it's being more difficult to justify than it should be. So, but if you look at this, the Medicaid physician fees for the 25 highest paying states, Alaska is shown on this as second, but in fact we do pay the highest. It's cost adjusted based on the cost of living in those areas, but we are significantly higher than any of the other states. In most other states, I believe there's four states that pay higher than Medicare, and Alaska, as you will see, pays considerably higher than Medicare in across the board.
Representative Wilson.
How many states have added a copay, or have states done that? Because I've heard that if even a $5 copay might make a difference for somebody rushing to the doctor if there was, you know, some kind of gain.
Representative Wilson, through the chair, if I talk about copays just a little further on in this, and there's a good side and a bad side to copays, and I would like to touch on that if I could at that point.
No problem.
Payment comparisons. This is 2009 payment levels for a level 5 office visit. That's the highest level office visit in a primary care physician office, generally, 99215. Alaska Medicaid pays $209.11. Alaska Medicare pays $164.32. Washington Medicaid pays $76. And Montana Medicaid pays $129.21. Just to show you, a snapshot of other states. We did a series of about a dozen states, and in every case it was similar in the example. But you see that 499215, we pay considerably better than Medicare. Benefits. States that provide optional benefits can eliminate them for adults. We can't touch EPSDT, the early periodic screening, diagnosis, and treatment, and nursing facility services. In other words, nursing home services are not optional. States can establish limits on benefits for certain adults, can be hard or soft limits, depending on the benefit that you do choose. Back to reducing benefits in one area may cause cost increases in another. We'll talk about this more again later, but one of the areas where you could reduce an optional benefit is in terms to our waiver programs. And if we reduce those benefits in the waiver programs or our personal care attendant programs, most of these folks meet nursing home level of care. So by eliminating one of those services, there's a chance that the person will be forced into a nursing home, which would be a considerable push on the balloon, if you will. Federal litigation, Medicaid rules, and the Olmstead Act. The Olmstead Act requires that we provide services in the least restrictive setting that we can. May need to address transition issues if we do eliminate a service, and how do we ensure that they receive continuing services in the other area. CMS approval of a SPA, you can see that throughout the whole thing. And the impact on access and quality of care. Because so much of our optional programs are very much built into our continuum of care of services. and we may create a gap, and as I've already said, force them into a higher level of care that they may not require.
Representative Jewell.
Thank you. I'm just sitting here thinking that I know that you're talking to us here, and we know what you mean by a push on the balloon, that if you cut the PCA costs here, you're going to pay more money for hospital care, in-home care, or something else. But but there's probably a wider audience out there that may not understand what the push on the balloon might mean, and it's a significant additional cost, is it not?
Through the chair, Representative Julie, yes, it is a significant cost. In fact, if we look at nursing home level of care, I think Kim can back me up on this, but for many of the people in our waiver program, the average cost on an annual basis is in the $30,000 a year involved in the waiver program. And you put someone in a nursing home, I think it's in the...
$202,000 a year.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Commissioner.
Yeah, Commissioner, I got an email the other day about a person who took their, I guess his brother, out of assisted care living, or that you're paying $17,000 a month for, something like that. Is that, I might be a little high on the number. And they took him out and wanted to become personal care attendants, but they couldn't afford to. I think they have the person, but they can't, they don't make enough money to, you know what I mean, to close the gap. And it seemed like that would be an incentive for us, meaning the state, to up the personal care attendant if they take a person out of assisted care living or and move them down, like we were just talking about. They're looking at going back the other way now because they can't afford to keep the person home. So just an idea. Somehow, you know, when they make that move, we should encourage them to keep them, but not say, yeah, you get 3 hours a week to take care of them. You know, like, it's not worth it. It's hard for them because they end up giving up a job for this. So just an idea. I'll talk to you about it. I'll give you the email. So, okay.
Mandatory versus optional benefits. I want to put this slide in front of you because one of the easy solutions is, well, just cut out the optional benefits of Medicaid. And it's not that easy because when you look at the mandatory benefits, that's the motherhood and apple pie that we all know about, in that those of us without chronic complex medical conditions, when we need a level of care, that's where we look toward. Inpatient hospital, outpatient hospital, nurses, physicians, nurse midwives, lab and x-ray, AMPs, advanced nurse practitioners, early periodic screening, diagnosis and treatment, family planning, pregnancy, et cetera. Look on the other side. Mental health, rehab, and stabilization. Do you want to cut that out? Diagnostic screening, preventive therapies, inpatient psychiatry, drugs. The pharmacy program costs about $65 million a year. Cutting out the pharmacy program to our Medicaid recipients would be a significant challenge to us. Intermediate care facilities, mental retardation, ICFMRs, we refer to them, they're inpatient residential facilities for those with very complex medical and mental conditions. Personal care attendants, dental services. We served about 10,000 people in the adult dental program, and for every argument that I have against the adult dental program, I have a story that has been provided to me about someone who went back into the workplace, was able to eat caribou again, and those kinds of things that we don't think about. And it's been a wonderful program. Other home health services, other licensed practitioners, transportation. We spend about $70 million a year on transportation in the state of Alaska. For Representative Jewell and Representative Thomas, if we didn't have those services for the people of Kotzebue or Haines or many of the other villages out there, the care would not be there. And so we need to, you know, take a look at that. But and, you know, other areas that we have. So it's a tough, tough challenge to look at. Where do we cut? Whose ox do we gore?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Jewell.
And on that slide, mandatory as it relates to adult care and and optional as it relates to adult care, and then for children, those things have different meanings. And I was surprised to see how those costs break out and between the optional and mandatory and how that plays out. Because I think on this one, I just wanted to point out that on some of the adult things that we do and the costs we incur come in the optional line. I mean, a huge amount. And then when you look over to the children's services part, there's not much optional that we do there. It's almost all mandatory. And I was kind of surprised to see how all of that interacts with each other.
Representative Jewell, through the chair, it is a good point. Medicaid, CHIP, SCHIP, are very much oriented toward children first and family second. Beginning in 2014, every man, woman, and child eligible, meeting that 138% poverty level, will be eligible under Medicaid. And I think that we're still going to see the optional versus mandatory for children, but we're going to see much more of a melding together on that. So. Utilization controls, I think this is probably the area that I want to give the greatest attention to for the Medicaid program, because you've all heard me say this. We spend $1.5 billion very successfully in Medicaid, and half the time I don't know if we're spending the money, the right care, the right time, the right place, for the right people, and for the right amount of money, and it's always a challenge for us. And so we need to do a better job on a wide range of controls and screens to ensure that we are providing the right care to people. The new MMIS system, the new Medicaid Management Information System, which pays our claims in the state of Alaska, is coming online the spring of 2012, and it can't come soon enough for me. I had a conversation today about bringing our data warehouse system up and taking our data that's currently in the old MMIS system and bring it into the new data warehouse so we can begin to implement some of the utilization controls earlier. Our Medicaid Management Information System that we currently have is a 25-year-old COBOL-based non-relational system that pays claims very, very well. We just don't know how it's paying them or anything else, and we can't go back and pull the data unless we build a report, literally, for the program. I'm hopeful that by mid-fall, we will be able to have our data warehouse up to begin to pull the data, and it will help Kim's group immeasurably, as well as our behavioral health and senior disability services folks.
Commissioner, this is Clark and we got three questions early here. Representative Gareth, Fairclough, and Jewell.
Thank you, Commissioner. This is where I get to sound like a Republican with this question. And, I wish Representative Stoltz were here today. He was lamenting that we had agreed twice today already. there is... I can't quantify it, but I run into a lot of people who are on Medicaid, who get sick, who go straight to the emergency room for non-emergency room-related health problems. But they know they can be seen in the emergency room. And maybe it's not as rampant a problem as I think it is. But is there any sort of behavior modification that can be done in terms of if you go to the emergency room where you had another available medical provider, you do have to pay a significant portion of your rate. We'd pay the full 100% if you go to first care or urgent care. But sort of you do it twice, and maybe the first time we let you slide, the second time it's going to cost you a lot of money. Is there any sort of behavior modification we can do that way? Oh, is that cruel? Is it a terrible thing to do?
Representative Guerra, through the chair, I'm so proud.
Representative Stoltz, to you.
Representative Guerra, that is something that we can do. It is something that we're looking at. We do have, in the system, we talk about frequent flyers, people that tend to use higher cost services. They tend to self-refer to specialists. They tend to doctor shop. They tend to visit emergency rooms very frequently. And there are options that we can do. And when we talk about co-pays and deductibles and things, that is an option. I think there's a better solution to that, and that's putting people in the medical homes and making sure that the service that they can access the services more readily. But there are people that I had a client a recipient in a former health plan that I had, it was a Medicaid health plan, that visited the emergency room 300 times in 1 year. He was a single male, but that was where he could get a good night's sleep. It's where he could get a meal. It was where he could get the services, but it was costing me anywhere between $600 and $800 before we finally put a stop to it. So those options are available. There's a downside to it, and so it's figuring out a better, smarter way to do it, but yet help them realize that they have skin in the game and they're very much a part of it.
Representative Fairclough and then Jewell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Along the same lines, the MMIS system that we currently have, am I to understand that we can't track some of the things that are happening with individual families based on the current way that we collect data, and that the new system that will be available that we can cross-tab services that are accessed in a different way?
Representative Fairclough, through the chair, that information is available to us. We have to literally build a report every time that we want to do it, and it's taking programmer time. It's costing us considerable effort to get it. We can get the information, but it doesn't come without lots of pain.
Mr. Chair.
Follow up, yep.
Thank you. Are we tracking whether we have duplicated services that are being accessed? Then $1.5 billion, and when I look at the number that we say that are accessing in sheer population numbers, it looks like there's a high percentage of Alaskans that are accessing the Medicaid system. And when we look at the services that are available, they're accessing them at different access points. So if you go into the dental office and you're aware of what Medicaid may pay for, then you go into a mental health office, it's a different doctor, and you're accessing care there, and there's something to be said for a holistic approach to someone. So that's one question. Are we looking at people or families now to try to look at care in a more holistic way instead of just crisis intervention? And then the second, do we have any kind of controls on an annual spending limit inside of the Medicaid system as far as services that are available? And by the limit, I mean, if they're accessing enough services that they should be in a home, do we have that trigger in the system somewhere where they're becoming, they have greater needs, their needs are escalating, and so can we turn them into a different place to access service?
Representative Fairclough, through the chair, in regards to your first question, we are trying to look at families, and we are, I think, doing it in the best way that we can with the information that we have available. Each Medicaid recipient has their own Medicaid ID number, and they're not familial linked. And so what we have to do is, if we have a Jones family, we don't know if it's one family, four families, or five families, and that is one of the areas that a data warehouse would give us, because we're allowed to put in groupings at that point. So we are not doing that at this point. We're looking at individuals only. In regards to the expense, $1.5 billion, the number of Medicaid recipients that we have accessing the system on an annual basis, it comes to about $9,300 per member per year is being spent on Medicaid. Take that, multiply that by family of four, $36,000 a year. Add to that a 15% overhead that is normally added to a health benefit to charge a premium. That gets to be real money on a monthly basis, that if you or I were purchasing those services, $36,000 a year divided by 12 months, at $3,000 per month premium that we would have for health insurance. So it is very, very expensive, and that's why we need to bend the curve in the state of Alaska. I'm less concerned about the climb than I am about the overall spend that we have and the fact that we need to get a grip on this, and that's why I think utilization controls and getting a handle on what we're spending, making sure that we don't have the duplicative stuff, the MRIs getting repeated, the CAT scans getting repeated because you don't have scan or because you don't have contrast or a variety of reasons that we're doing. It is an issue and it's something that we're watching as best we can, but it's why I need to bring the data warehouse up. And by the way, that is all pre-funded, so that's paid for.
Representative Jewell.
Question asked and answered, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you.
Prior authorization. We recently rebid our prior authorization process, our prior authorization and care management process vendor, and we're moving to a fully electronic prior authorization and care management system with them at a considerable savings. One of the things that I think Kim is looking at with regards to that area is how can we get more bang out of the services that we are to begin to focus on those things. Right now, the majority of what we do in terms of prior authorization is hospital-based, and you know, I'd like to expand it to many other areas as well, because outpatient hospital is one of our faster-growing areas, and it's something that we need to begin to look at. Post-payment reviews, looking at those non-prior authorized processes and beginning to look at post-payment review. You know, why are we doing three CAT scans for the same procedure with three different referral sources and beginning to focus on that? Hard and soft edits, taking a look at where we've got outliers. You know, why are we doing a CAT scan for a bunion diagnosis and those kinds of things, beginning to link the services more closely with diagnosis. Bundling, unbundling, and order of billing. These are billing tools that we use with hospitals, with physicians' offices. It's paying for a bundled set of services, such as a delivery, grouping it all into a single billing. New edits and audits for fee-for-service. If I could move away from fee-for-service, and come up with some other options, it's something that we'd like to take a look at. Improved purchasing. Medicaid's significant market share. You know, $1.5 billion, it's a lot of food going, a lot of feed going into the economy in the state of Alaska at considerable cost to the state of Alaska as well. Is there a better way to do this? DME continues to be, durable medical equipment continues to be a challenge for us, and I think it's something that you know, we need to look at, is there a better way to do that? Pharmacy. One of the areas that I'm very proud of is that we have a generous pharmacy benefit in terms of the range of drugs that we provide. Yet on a per recipient basis, we do very well in our returns on it, in our overall management of it, and in our satisfaction, both on the provider and recipient side, with medications. That doesn't mean that we aren't still looking at options and better ways to do it. It's when you move from being parsimonious to invasive. And that's what why we have the Pharmacy and Therapeutics Committee, P&T Committee. It's providers and pharmacists that get together on a quarterly basis and thoroughly review what we're doing with our drugs. Provider manufacturer contracting, this is what we do with pharmacy. I don't think that we have a lot of option in the state of Alaska. We maybe spend a lot of money, but most manufacturer contracts don't want to look at cover lives of 100,000. That's not a big enough pool for them. And centers of excellence, beginning to reward excellence when we can. Cost sharing, this was a point that was brought up by Representative Wilson. Recipient pays a portion of the cost of services, personal responsibility, reduction in inappropriate utilization to deal with Representative Guerra's point. Recipient assumes a portion of the responsibility for services. Considerations that we have to look at is may cause care to be delayed in some instances, resulting in higher costs later. Persons asked to be make a copay to be involved in their care. For those that are following the rules, they may say, well, you know, I really should go into the doctor's office, but I have a $5 copay. So we need to be very careful about where we place cost sharing and how we do the cost sharing. Medicaid rules are very complex and prescriptive. There's only so much of a percentage of a person's annual income that you can charge them for on an annual basis. We do not have the tracking to be able to do that at this point. I think that beginning to cost share more in the areas of forcing people to make decisions when they can make decisions is where we need to focus. But it may result in a reduction in provider revenues. And that's one of the big things I heard in speaking with some of the provider groups that I've been talking to about, because I've enlisted as many provider groups as I could in the solutions to this thing and sit down with them and say, you know, I don't want to gore your ox. I want to roast an ox with you. How can we do this? And asking them to be involved in what we do. Existing cost sharing in Alaska, $50 per day up to a maximum of $200 per discharge for inpatient hospital services. 5% of charges for outpatient hospital services. $3 per day for physician services. And $2 for each prescription filled and refilled. I'll bet that we have less than 50% collection on that. The provider has less than 50% collection on that.
Representative Guerra.
Going back to the last slide, which goes back to my last question, Commissioner. Is it a significant cost, people going to the emergency room when they don't have to in the Medicaid system? Is that something we should be paying attention to?
Representative Guerra, through the chair, no.
It's not a significant cost? Okay.
Thank you, my Republican friend over there, Representative Stoltz.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. One of the things from providers who, the physicians I talk to, they have their formula to figure out how many patients they have to see before they even break even on a given day. And, you know, they're a real business. And they anecdotally and verifiably both have told me, both dental providers and medical providers, they say their worst offenders for no-shows are Medicaid patients. And we have prohibitions on that. How do we, we're already punishing these people by paying a fraction of a percentage, their total cost, and maybe losing money to begin with, and then they lose that whole, they lose maybe a full paying patient. That's a real serious concern for me, and we've never really had any adequate answers to address that. And I would like to pull the hammer as far back on that. I don't want people to be denied services who need them desperately, but I don't want to have such a casual attitude about, especially when you have providers who are really challenged to try to break even. And there's this myth that a lot of these guys are getting wealthy, and men and women. That's a real serious concern, and it's always I hear a lot of songs and dances on this, and I think it's something that we're trying to figure out how to help providers. If I was somebody, I just want to take any. If you want to get real, I don't want them to get so crass that they're just not going to take those patients at all. And just out of economic necessity, we can love this issue to death and make the problem even worse than it is. You have any commentary on that,
Representative Stoltz, through the chair? I think our dental providers is a good example of that. The dental providers, two person, when I meet with them, their single greatest rub with treating Medicaid recipients is no-show. And anecdotally, they have told me time and again about their no-show rates versus otherwise. A couple of dentists are now tracking that for us and trying to show a side-by-side comparisons between their Medicaid recipient no-show rate and their non-Medicaid recipient no-show rate. I suggested to them that, you know, if they were going across the board charge for no-shows, we don't have any problem with that. The problem is that they don't want to make it across the board policy to charge for no-shows. They only want to do it with Medicaid recipients, and we can't allow that. But it is a significant issue. I hear less out of physicians' offices than I do out of dental providers, but it is very definitely an issue with our dental providers.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure it's so simple as those folks I've talked to. I think I'm not sure it's as simply. I'll trust you on this. You know more. You've forgotten more about Medicaid than I know. So. But and I have a fairly good memory. So that's. I don't know. I just right now it just seems it almost. With all due respect, I almost think like I almost got a flip response back on a very serious problem. And I know you didn't mean it that way, but that's how I took it, and I think that's how a lot of the profession took it and will take it. Anyway, and I don't mean that disrespectfully, but I think we ought to try a little harder on that.
Representative Schultz, to the chair, I didn't take the flip because I have the same challenge with it. I don't know how to do it, and it's an entitlement program. And it's a very difficult challenge for us, and I've enlisted the provider support on it. I don't have the answer.
Okay. Well, I'm going to encourage them to keep beating at your door, and I think they're going to have more voices listening. Not everybody is totally as sympathetic to the entitlement side. I'll leave it at that.
Representative Fairclough.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Serving locally, this particular issue of no-shows raises its ugly head in numerous situations. And so if we're doing a tabulation or a survey of no-shows, as you said, the fairest way to do it is all no-shows so that we can see if there's a particular preponderance in a particular community or age group or other reasons. But one of the issues that had been in front of Anchorage was transportation, and that many of the people who may not or may fail to show up an appointment did so because transportation didn't show up when it was supposed to get them there, specifically people on share a ride or other transportation that's dependent on a group of people bringing them to a particular location. So I'm in agreement with my co-chair's concerns on no-shows and would point to the Alaska Native Medical Center, who actually has implemented some fairly successful strategies along the lines of what Representative Guerra had said. I'm not sure the specific program, but it does have something to do with paying a small fee for a no-show fee, basically, but trying to get an understanding conveyed through a community that is accessing services to understand that a doctor's time is valuable, a dentist's time is valuable, and that they could have a different client in there that may be a revenue generator. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Guerra.
I've had this conversation with the commissioner in my office trying to figure out a way to do a copay and things like that, and just so folks can understand the difficulty that he's facing, the administrative burden of a lot of the stuff costs more than the savings. And, you know, I missed 4 dental appointments this summer because every time I thought that my back was going to be good enough that I could go in there and sit in the chair, and every day the appointment came across, I couldn't. And I thought it was nice for my dentist not to charge you, but then you're going to have to get into this issue of proof. Was there a good reason the person showed up or didn't show up? And then with the copays, does it cost more to get the copay and then chase somebody down for the copay than not? I mean, I think we all want the answer to be that there's a way to collect some of this money. The one thing I have to recognize, too, when I asked you these questions was that sometimes it costs more to enforce the rule than you're going to get out of it. Not that there's not an answer out there, but the easy answer is not out there, I don't think.
Say Wilson.
I just want to add shortly, it's not just about the cost of it, but I know there's tenants back in Fairbanks who no longer will take Medicaid patients because there's been so many cancellations. So, you know, the more providers that we lose, that takes away from the program in itself. So I think it's both not just rectifying it, but we just can't afford to keep losing more and more. And I'm sure it happens with doctors as well, and that's why there's such a shortage.
I bet you, if there's a Medicare patient that finds a doctor, I bet you they're careful not to blow an appointment.
Shouldn't be there.
Existing cost sharing in Alaska, inpatient hospital up to $50 per day, up at a maximum of $200. Outpatient hospital, 5% of charges, $3 for physician, $2 for each prescription refilled. I already said that the amount of, that is actually collected on that is probably minuscule because of just the HAFA factor and the difficulty and just not going after it. Services exempt from cost sharing, there's a whole list of those. All at recipients under the age of 18. Services provided to a recipient long-term care facility. Pregnant women, including postpartum, family planning services, emergency services, hospice care, tribal health services provided to American Indian or Alaska Native. Services provided to an individual who is eligible for both Medicare and Medicaid when Medicare is the primary care of the services, in other words, dual coverage. On the Alaska Native thing, it's Medicaid can't mandate that for them. They can still have an internal if they choose to have that. Inability to pay cost share is always the issue. The provider may not deny services to any eligible individual on account of the individual's inability to pay the cost sharing amount. And one thing I can say in Alaska is that we do not have complaints about access to care being denied because someone was not able to pay their cost share on that. Our providers have really stepped up on this and for the most part try to work with us and try to ensure that the care is there. Anti-fraud, to keep this moving, some states may be an untapped area for savings. Fraud in Medicaid is a reality. The extent of the fraud in Medicaid, I can't tell you. As I said, our efforts with the AG's office and our own efforts are going to be stepped up. Numerous methods and vendors, we have a Medicaid Integrity Program, we have PERM, we have a variety of areas.
Question, Chairman Stoltz.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. On the issue of Medicaid fraud, is it typical I remember a few years back, Senator Lyda Green initiated an effort on the Medicaid fraud. I think Steve Branchflower was working with the Department of Law on that, as I recall. There was some clamping down and some success, but typically in terms of offenses, but in terms of dollars, is Medicaid fraud more typically involving a patient or a provider?
Through the chair, Representative Stoltz, in terms of recoveries, it's more related to providers. There's more money involved. In terms of recipients, you're going to get bits and pieces of it, but if it's going to be recipient fraud that you're going to identify any significant amount of money, it's going to be related to prescription drugs.
Prescription drugs. And in terms of, I mean, what's a typical big, I mean, just without naming names, I mean, what are the magnitudes of some of the provider fraud? Give us an example of something that's been egregious. They're all egregious, but give me your worst example and without any names.
Through the chair, Representative Stoltz, I think the majority of the provider fraud settlements that we've put in place are going to be in the neighborhood of between $25,000 and $125,000 to $150,000 maximum. There's been one outlier on call nursing, and I don't remember the exact amount, but I think that was in the millions.
Do they not lose their license if you're a licensed doctor and you're defraud the state, isn't there should be a penalty? I'm sure that our new Republican friend on the left, if he got penalized for doing something like that, he would lose his license. It's an inside joke. He missed his speech a little while ago, so.
Not a bit.
Well, you'd like it.
Representative Thomas, it depends on the extent of the fraud, but we, on a weekly basis, are provided a list of those who are no longer allowed to participate in Medicare, at which time, in many cases, we pull their participation in Medicaid, too, and sometimes we are mandated by CMS to pull their participation. Alaska, I'd have to check further on the answer to that.
It seems like if you stole something, it's a felony, and if you're convicted of a felony, and my friends at the end of it, you lose your license, so it seems like we should treat everybody fairly, and if it's because they're big, rich, whatever provider they are, nobody goes forward. So maybe there's some legislation in that.
And Mr. Chairman, not every fraud investigation is really born with malice either. So the regulations and laws are pretty complicated. You could find yourself in fairness, in the midst of one of those investigations totally accidentally too. Is that a fair assessment, Commissioner?
Representative Schultz, through the chair, that is a fair statement.
But maybe when you settle, you sign a little release saying, "Well, we'll settle with you, but we won't penalize or file charges too." So I'm not going to get into that anyway.
You could get charged with Medicaid fraud if you were charging people too little in comparison to others. I mean, I've heard about those cases. Dealing with the federal programs. Well, I don't know how. It's not about practicing medicine as much as it is trying to keep up with all the complicated federal regulations at times, and which we're forced to support. So I wasn't trying to beat up on providers. There's a flip. There are some people that truly egregiously try to stretch every program and abuse it, and then some that fall into it just because it's so gosh darn complicated. How's that for a cleanup?
There you go. But my argument is going to be if you're a driver, you get points against you, you lose your driver's license. I'm a commercial fisherman. I have so many violations, I lose my license. You should have the same kind of thing with, depending on the points. If they took you for $1 million, you know, and then the next guy does it for $150, that's a lot of money. It's more than most people get paid here in a room. I mean, this table up here in a year. Anyway, I just think that's something should be done now. Anyway, let's go ahead and go. You've got 15 minutes here. I was at a half an hour.
You've got a lot of time.
You're doing good.
Mr. Chairman, we have a lot of material as well. It is a politically popular place to obtain reduction, but I think, as you pointed out, it's being judicious about it and going after those that are intentional and those that make a mistake. We need to move on, collect our money and move on. So you're going to hear more about that. Director Poppy Smart is who happens to hold a law degree, will be able to answer a lot of your questions with regard to fraud. Anti-fraud efforts, audits, and other activities in Alaska, we got a bunch of them. Surveillance utilization reviews, the SURS program, is where we go in and we take a look at payment patterns, we take a look at diagnoses that they're using, we take a look at recipients that are visiting multiple doctors and receiving multiple prescriptions, those kinds of things, and beginning to look for outliers, basically, people that rise to the top. In terms of a physician, we talked about 99215 being the highest level of the visit code. Two physicians side by side, three physicians maybe, and you take a look at one and two of them are billing at 40% or 99215s, and the third one is billing at 90% 99215s. Chances are that's going to rise to the top, and we're going to take a look at them and give them a call and say, can you explain this to us? And that alone is a deterrent if the person is perhaps billing inappropriately. Audits required by Alaska statute, those are the Meyer and Stauffer audits that all of you have had a phone call about at one time or another. We do 70 of those a year under statute, and are marginally effective. They're difficult, but they are somewhat effective. Credit balance audits, I'm not going to go into that. We don't do a lot of that. Focus reviews, it's where we identify someone that a provider who is an outlier, and we go in and we take a look at that, or we look at a particular pattern, a particular group of providers, and do a focus review on that group to see if there are outliers. CMS Medicaid Integrity Program, that kicks off this year. It's called the MIP. And the Medicaid Integrity Program is much like what Medicare has been doing, where Medicare goes in and conducts audits with the providers. It's you haven't heard a lot about that yet. It's going to be significant. Payment error rate measurement, that's the PERM program you heard about last year. Alaska had the best percentage in the nation by half of anybody else. And we were less than 1%. I think that the next closest one was a 2% or just under 2% error rate. What that is CMS comes in and a CMS vendor comes in and takes a look at what we pay for a particular service and making sure that that service was paid appropriately. So even though we do have a 25-year-old system paying claims, it is a pretty accurate system. Cluster audits, I'm not going to go into a whole lot. There's been lots of jokes about that title. Medicaid Recovery Audit Contractors, that's the RAC program, and that's a program that we hope will replace the AS4705-200 audits in the near future, because it's almost a mirror image except it's done by the federal government on a required contract for us, by us, with them. And we do not feel that we need to do both a RAC contract, a RAC audit, and a Myers software type audit. And then the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit, and this is where I talked about the Attorney General and I sitting down talking about how can we get the maximum benefit from our interaction with Medicaid Fraud Control Unit. Provider taxes. I know you all love taxes, and I see some of you scowling at this. Provider taxes provides a means to generate revenue specifically to fund Medicaid. The way provider tax works, in a quick nutshell, is that we charge a tax provider for the services that they provide. They pay the taxes, and we use that to supplant general fund money, but also to pay them at a higher rate and to offset some of the provider tax that they have, because we get 50% federal participation. So what it basically does, it allows us to charge a tax and leverage our federal participation on Medicaid. Use is growing as budgets decrease. I believe almost 15 states, 14 or 15 states, have implemented provider tax in the last 18 months. Can provide needed provider rate increases and avoid decreases. Can provide money for the state, once again be leveraging the federal money. And some provider types have worked better than others. Physicians' offices, non-specialty physicians' offices, primary care offices, A&Ps, and other primary care providers, it tends to work better in than with a specialty group where Medicaid assesses a provider tax and it's assessed against all that specialist income, and when in fact the majority of the specialist income is not related to Medicaid. And federal rules are complex, but the taxes do work. Alaska's never provided that, pursued that.
Representative Wilson.
I hope this is on point. I just can't imagine taxing the providers. We don't pay them necessarily what they're worth. Why is the federal government making an incentive for states to do this?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, there's no incentive for the states to do this. It is an option that states, federal government did not bring this up. The states brought it up. States need to come up with match, and the general fund money through other sources is no longer available, or Medicaid costs continue to go up. They do have a 50% match rate in a state like ours, and states are looking at any way that they can come up with the match necessary to continue to move forward the Medicaid program and not be painful on the recipients in the state.
I'm going to leave it at that. Thank you.
Chairman? Just was that a bit of salesmanship? Or, I mean, you were floating, you were flying the flag to see if anybody saluted? I didn't. You made the pitch and then said, well, we don't do it, and we're probably not going to. I imagine there are enough pages you didn't add one just for the heck of adding it.
Representative Stoltz, through the chair, I didn't add it just to add it. I presented it as one of the options just to fully disclose all the things that are available to you in terms of funding Medicaid. It's unlikely in a state like ours with an aversion to any kind of taxes. Taxes are levied against all providers of a certain type. I've already explained that part. Taxation will affect
mover in the herd, but I got it now.
Taxes will affect current payment methodology. Tax payments can be accounted for in cost-based payment methodologies for hospitals and nursing homes. Where used, the industry is more in support than not for the taxation. If Alaska Medicaid cuts funding, industry support may develop. If implemented in Alaska, there will be a high degree of CMS oversight. I'm not even going to bring that forward with you at all. As been very clearly pointed out. Revenue maximization, most states have focused on this. There still may be opportunities. I think that's an opportunity in Alaska to continue to move this, particularly with our tribal partners. Allowable federal funding can replace state funding. States should make sure the reviews are current. Opportunities with state and local programs and certain inmate care. When Medicaid-eligible IHS beneficiaries receive services at an IHS facility, the state receives 100% federal participation. In state fiscal year 2010, if all Alaska Native Medicaid recipients had received services exclusively from IHS facilities, it would have saved Alaska Medicaid about $108 million in general fund.
That's in addition to what they provide also.
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
I have a question.
Do
you have any idea how many folks that are participating in Nally Kid Care that could be doing this? Do we have any ballpark number? Just as one example of an alternative program.
To the chair, Representative Stoltz, I don't have that number available right now, but I think...
Do you even have a guess? Is it in the tens of millions of that 108, or...
Through the chair, Representative Stoltz, this is Medicaid only, this $108 million. The issue that we get into is where I don't think that we can realize any savings from this is probably in cardiac care, cancer care, and in complex children's conditions. I think those are good.
Just that you titillate was the number we might be able to save something and say there's nothing we can do about it. That's frustrating. Go ahead.
Through the chair, Representative Stoltz, I think that there's still probably at least half of that that we could realize through a more effective partnership with our tribal partners. Nursing home care and the activities that we've undertaken with nursing home care. Kotzebue will be opening here this coming fall. In other areas, that there are opportunities and it's low-hanging fruit, and I think anytime we could add $15, $20, or $30 million to the bottom line in savings, it's something that we do need to take a look at. But no, the $108 million isn't there.
Thank you.
Representative Jewell.
Thank you. Earlier this week under budget overviews, we heard from Melissa Stone with behavioral health. And I believe that there was a statement made with regards to Medicaid and behavioral health and opportunities. And I'm wondering if you can, and I don't know how much of that may be associated with IHS facilities, and I'm just wondering if you could speak to that if it does.
Through the chair, Representative Jewell, I believe that she was probably talking about the behavioral health encounter rate, and that we have begun reimbursing, and I've gone back 3 years on reimbursing for 2 or 3 years reimbursing at an encounter rate for all behavioral health services. That will go a long way toward fully funding behavioral health services within the IHS community. The continuing operation, the continuum care. And it's also going to cut down on transportation because a lot of times, particularly with kids and families, they were required to ship out, enter an RPTC or something, and then we now have the services available in communities.
Thank you. Representative Wilson.
Could we get a breakdown on the $108 million, the part that we can do something about, what services that are potential? You know, are they with children, young children, old, just some kind of breakdown?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, I've already requested that information. I just wasn't able to get it in time for this.
Go ahead. Thank you.
Home and community-based strategies. Kim began with the department taking on the corrective action plan for senior disability services, and then assumed the interim directorship, and then came over to Medicaid to, because she didn't have enough challenges anymore. So Kim is going to talk a little bit about our proposed strategies for home and community-based services.
Mr. Co-Chairs and committee members, again, for the record, my name is Kim Poppy Smart, currently the Director of Healthcare Services, and as Commissioner Struer indicated, spent most of the last year as the Acting Director of Senior and Disability Services, which is why I come to you today with this information regarding the long-term care strategies that have been proposed through the Medicaid Task Force as options for controlling costs in Medicaid in the long-term care arena. We have obviously morphed our Medicaid 101 into a 101.5, where we are proposing some strategies, which is where the provider tax and other things came into play. In the long-term care arena, we know, based on multiple studies and reports over the years, that that population is growing in Alaska. It is outpacing other states, particularly as we talk about the elderly. Long-term care includes also those individuals receiving long-term care for disabilities. Home and community-based services in Alaska have been in place for a while, and we have been incredibly successful at keeping individuals out of institutions. Therefore, we don't have the same opportunity other states have to control our spending, knowing that institutional care is far more expensive than home and community-based care. We can make few, if any, gains in that arena. We have about 708 nursing home beds here in the state. They are full except for maybe 10 or 20 beds at any given time. So they are well utilized. But in the community, we have about 3,500 individuals on home and community-based services through our four waiver programs. We also have about 3,500 individuals receiving personal care attendant services, half of whom are also waiver recipients. So when we do the cost breakdowns, I told you previously that institutional care for a nursing home is about $202,000 a year on average in the state of Alaska. If you're an older Alaskan receiving waivered services at home, the average cost to the Medicaid program is about $30,000. If you're also receiving personal care attendant services, the average cost is an additional $33,000. So that $63,000 is certainly much less than $202,000 it would cost to be in a nursing home if a bed were available for you. Of our personal care program, I said there are 3,500 individuals on that program. All but 500 of them have demonstrated an institutional level of care need. So 500 individuals have needs that rise to the level of an institution, but 3,000 do. So that's the population we're dealing with when we're evaluating the numbers and looking at the dollars for care that's provided in those arenas. Other service options included in the long-term care arena are those few individuals who are in institutes providing care to individuals with intellectual or developmental disabilities, ICFMRs. Those are out-of-state placements. We have very few, but there are some. It also includes administrative wait days and swing beds in critical access hospitals, so they act as nursing home beds in acute care facilities. So other reductions that states implemented prior to maintenance of effort requirements is they were able to cut services or able to cut eligibility criteria. Today, we could not change our tools to determine eligibility for our waiver programs and be more restrictive. That is, require a higher level of need than we currently do. That is not in conformity with the maintenance of efforts requirements that we're currently bound by until 2014. So we have few options for reducing or restricting our current services, but we have to be more creative and think outside the box and look to what other states have done successfully. Long-term managed care is one option that we've seen other states utilize. They'll develop a demonstration project or a certain state plan amendment to put a group of folks who require long-term care services or because of their disease categories are anticipated to require long-term care services in the future, and they're managed in a more holistic manner, similar to the medical home model, but they consider it long-term managed care. The other consideration is Medicaid is the primary payer for long-term care services. Very few private insurance companies will pay for any of these services, even long-term care insurance. They don't pay for home and community-based services for the most part. Medicare pays for some institutional days, but there's a maximum on that of 100 days. State plan option for personal care attendant services. We could look at revamping our current PCA program and develop a new program under a demonstration project once again. There is a certain opportunity right now through the Affordable Care Act that's been put out that actually has a 6% federal match enhancement to it. It does require that we build in oversight quality monitors that don't currently exist in our PCA program. So that is an opportunity that's being evaluated. Some smaller but meaningful in other state programs include promoting safe independence in the home. That would be providing a service that we don't currently provide to have the home evaluated for safety, grab bars and other things installed in the home, even when somebody doesn't quite meet the institutional level of care, so they wouldn't be eligible for a waiver service, but this becomes available to them through other programs. Commissioner Struer previously spoke about quality utilization and compliance management efforts. I can spell Medicaid. And the good thing about fraud in this state is to be found guilty of fraud in the state in Medicaid terms, you don't have to have the intention to commit fraud. You can be found guilty even if you have just reckless disregard, which is different from many other states who require that intentional element. So we are one step ahead in that arena, ahead or behind, depending upon what perspective you look at it from. And the last bullet here is examining options to refinance our current GF programs. So in the long-term care arena, we have general relief, which pays for assisted living homes for individuals who are not waiver eligible. We have the CAMA program, where we don't get a federal match for those individuals who have specific limited medical conditions, and we pay for ongoing medication services for them. Many of the studies in the past have recommended that we look at taking these populations and refinancing them by developing a demonstration project and getting the federal match, defining the eligibility criteria such that they fall within those categories of Medicaid eligible, and then we can divert some of that GF financing to the feds and get their match.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, two quick slides. One of the areas that I want to quickly close with is our third-party liability and our efforts in that. Third-party liability provides an opportunity to shift costs or collect money from other third-party entities, such as insurance companies, such as Medicare, estates, recoveries, and those kinds of things. A wide range of programs and activities, electronic matches to improve effectiveness, and contingent fee contracts are matchable, which we have in the state of Alaska. We don't do it all. But one of the things I'm very proud of is that our efforts on third-party liability have netted the state considerable return. Post-payment reviews, our net recovery is $9.1 million last year. Accident, estate recovery and trusts. Accident in this case is someone's involved in an accident. They receive a settlement from an insurance company. Perhaps they were at fault. We had to pay for their care while they were in the facility. We were able to go against that recovery that they have and collect on that $2.5 million. Cost avoidance, health insurance premium payments is where we assist with premium payments and provide coverage. Data matches with insurance companies, going in and taking a look at finding out where others' insurances may be involved. We have been very successful with that in finding out where someone perhaps is on Medicaid and they have a primary carrier, Blue Cross, and it hasn't been or may not have been reported to us. And the Medicare buy-in program where we buy in the Part A and B premiums, and the health care is provided under that. Our net saving on that was $35.4 million last year. Those are, you know, successful programs that we've had and that we continue to have. And that ends our presentation. I just want to say that if I get a little excited about this stuff, it's because I've been doing it for a long, long, long time. And Medicaid has been my life, so I greatly enjoy what I do. So thank you very much.
I get excited about anything that has at least six zeros behind it, so I'm glad you have enthusiasm.
Representative Jewell.
Thank you. And we've seen some of the in the beginnings of the slides, we've seen kind of the trends in percentages. To leave us with sticker shock, say in the last 3 years, what was the state's expenditures in the general fund dollars, say 3 years ago, if you have a handle on that, to what it might be at the end, looking forward to 2012?
Representative Jewell, through the chair, Allison's backing me up here, so I'm a little hesitant to estimate these, but I think in 2008, we're in the neighborhood of $1.1 billion, 2009, 1.2 and change, and this year we're going to be at 1.3, and so we continue to climb at...
And that's all general fund dollars?
No.
I'm talking about this general fund dollars. If I'm remembering right, I'm thinking it was like around $300 or $400 million of state GF. By the end of fiscal year 11, I think we're at about 700. And we may be approaching 850 or 800 and change, looking out to 12, depending on the FMAP stuff. And I don't know if I'm close, but.
Representative Jewell, through the chair, I think that you are very close. I think a little light on the 2007, 2008 and 9, we actually went down a little bit in our general fund share. 2010, we had a relatively minor increase. 2011, we were up. And 2012, we're looking at roughly $180 million by the time it's all over.
Thank you. Representative Dugan. Thank you. Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, I think since the last time I saw you for this, you were an acting commissioner. Now you've been appointed commissioner. And I just wanted to offer you congratulations or condolences might be more appropriate for that change of title. Thanks.
Any other questions, comments? Thank you, Commissioner. I was glad to have you here. We don't have a meeting tomorrow. Some of us have been bogged down with subcommittee meetings, and I think Co-Chair and I had three at one same hour this morning. Dancing around, so we won't meet tomorrow. We'll meet on Thursday, and we'll have Lenny Dees, Master Tax Auditor, Department of Revenue, talking about transferable tax credits. So, with that, we are adjourned till Thursday, 1:30.